Okay. Thank you for the invitation. It's really nice to be here, even though I'm freezing. It's like minus 20. No, but it's beautiful. It's gorgeous weather. So what I'm going to talk about today mostly, it's about a paper that I wrote in collaboration with Martin Amon and Nabil Ipkal this past June. And well, there's some follow-ups that we're working on, and I'll mention throughout the talk. But most of the material that I'll cover today, it's in that paper. So if you want to see more details, is my font, should I write bigger?
Yes.
Okay. I'll start writing bigger. But if you, most of the details, I'm not going to go through the details, so if you're interested in them, you should look it in there. So I should start. I lost my white chalk. So this topic, okay, so maybe you're not familiar with higher spin gravity. I'll tell you a little bit about higher spin gravity. Maybe you're not familiar with Wilson lines, maybe you are. But what I liked about this topic and what I want to start with is some motivation. And basically, our motivation, if you want, is threefold. And so you can pick your favorite motivation and then just follow the talk from there. So let's see. So I'll put in the three categories of motivation. But just so you're aware, so one of them is ADS-CFT. The other one is just a motivation within the field of higher spin gravity. You want, this is also known as Vasiliev gravity. So if you don't care about ADS-CFT, you might care about higher spin gravities. And a third motivation could be just that you're just interested, and this will be most of the focus of the talk today, on 2+1 dimensional gravity and its relationship with Chern-Simons theorem. This is going to be the most important aspect of the talk. So just to give you a little bit of context, I started with this one because this is a little bit where we were coming from. And so the motivation from this side is as follows. So ADS-CFT is a correspondence that tells us that we're capable of viewing a theory in anti-de Sitter space as a conformal field theory in one dimension lower. So if this theory lives in D plus one, this theory lives in D dimensions. And the nice thing about this proposal, well, it's not just about this proposal, but if you want a nice thing about gravity that we've learned in the past decades, is the following. There's two things that we've learned about gravity that I think are really remarkable. One is that geometry. Yeah, and this is, I shouldn't attribute it to ADS-CFT, but I just want to come from this angle. One statement is that geometry knows about thermodynamics. So we all know that black holes, the area of the black hole, can be associated to an entropy. It's a Bekenstein-Hawking formula. Furthermore, like the black hole knows about the second law, the first law of thermodynamics, it knows about all laws of thermodynamics. And that's a really non-trivial statement, the fact that geometry has encoded in itself thermodynamics. It's rather beautiful. But also in the context of holography, one thing that in the past years people realize is that geometry doesn't just know about thermodynamics, but geometry knows about entanglement. So there's a proposal out there in the, now I need to, so weird. There's a proposal out there in the context of ADS-CFT where they tell you, okay, so let's imagine that you have a theory, a CFT, living in the boundary, and you want it to compute entanglement entropy. So entanglement entropy basically means that you pick some interval. Oh, yeah, and I'm writing definitely too small. So let me do this drawing up here. So. The relationship with entanglement entropy in ADS-CFT The idea is as follows. You have a theory living in the boundary. You pick an interval. You can call it an interval X, a spatial integral. You define a density matrix associated to this interval. So you basically trace all the states outside the spatial interval. There will be an entanglement entropy associated to this interval that is equal to minus trace rho of x log rho of x. And how this information is encoded, so your gravitational theory is coming, goes into the bulk of the solution. And the way that the bulk, the gravitational solution, knows about that entanglement entropy, the prescription or the proposal is that the geodesic that hangs, so here I'm thinking that I'm in, let me do it for three and two dimensions. The geodesic that ends where this interval, where the interval ends, so this I have a curve here that will hang in the interior of the AES geometry. The length of the geodesic should be equal to this entanglement entropy. So the proposal, and this is a proposal by Ryu and Takenagi, so sometimes people call it the RT formula, tells you that the way you should think about this quantum information is in the context of holography is that it should be the length of this geodesic divided by 4 times g newt. Okay, so that's what I mean by the statement that in this context, geometry knows about entanglement entropy, about a quantity, a purely quantum information property. And it has been checked in various limits, and it has been studied and sort of used to understand better what entanglement entropy is and also understand better the geometrical relationship between these two quantities. That it's kind of, you want to say, somewhat trendy in this field to look at this proposal. But now, so this is something that I wanted to know more about and I was interested in, but I also been thinking a lot about higher spin gravities, and even though this story, these two concepts are kind of nice, I know how to phrase these statements and how to relate these statements in theories where my gravitational theory, my theory in ADS, so this works well for gravitational theories that are basically Einstein general relativity plus some matter. But nowadays, we know about a lot of theories. They're not just Einstein-like. They're not just general relativity. There's modifications of Einstein's equations. Just by, for example, you can add higher derivative terms or things like that. But there's even more violent modifications which fall into this category. So you might wonder, okay, so how do all of these proposals fit in general, more generally, more broadly speaking, in a larger class of gravitational theories? Like, would any gravitational theory have these two properties? And so we can test these properties for Einstein's theories, but a question that has been floating around is like, how true are these statements in other classes of theories? And the reason why this is not so obvious is because in these theories, so now you want to test, if you want the geometrical nature of these more strange, if you want, gravitational theories. And this has been somewhat challenging for the following reasons. So the main feature of these higher spin theories is that basically they're formulated as a gauge theory. So there's a really big gauge group that contains all the gauge symmetry associated to the higher spin fields that you have around. And this gauge group is much, much bigger than just the group of diffeomorphisms. So the diffeomorphisms sit inside this really large gauge group, but this gauge group has much more information. In particular, it mixes non-trivially diffeomorphisms with other, it will mix up the metric with the other higher spin fields. So you have to think here in this theories that the matter content that you have is basically you start with a spin 2 field, And then you keep on adding like a spin 3, a spin 4. And if you're Vasiliev, you go up to infinity. You can have an infinite number of higher spin fields interacting. And they're described by some given gauge group. And this and the gauge transformations just mix all these spin fields around.
So do you have propagating degrees of freedom? Or?
Yeah, so it depends. There are versions, so I'll come to that in a moment. But the most general Vasiliev theories do have propagating degrees of freedom, both in ADS4 and on ADS3. Yes?
And these gauge groups are finite dimensional Lie groups?
No. Well, I'll discuss. There are examples where they're finite dimensional. But if you have an infinite number of higher spin fields, which you're allowed, in ADS4 you have to have an infinite tower of higher spin fields, then the group is infinite dimensional as well. I'll come back to that in a moment. But there's an ADS in three dimensions for the reasons that I'll state in a moment. You can have finite dimensional groups as well. So in these theories, for instance, you can define a metric. You can figure out, like, there's a reason why you say that you have a spin 2 excitation. But the problem is that this metric, if you compute the associated, like, line element, or if you compute curvature invariance, so things like this, or whatever favorite invariant you had in Einstein-Hilbert gravity, all these things, linear emphatic, all this stuff is basically junk. Okay? They're not gauge invariant. You can do a gauge transformation and change drastically like the properties of what you would have so-called geometry. So things like if you're tempted to draw a Penrose diagram, let's say, this makes absolutely no sense. If you wanted to define what you meant by a horizon, well, related to this, the horizons are really ambiguous. Things like causal, like in general, like I'm just listing things that are all related to each other. But causal structure, it's also ambiguously defined. So it's a theory of gravity in the sense that you can identify one propagating degree of freedom that is spin 2, but every other aspect of what we are familiar about gravity, like kind of goes away, and then you lose a lot of your intuition. So if you, people studying this higher spin theory, is like the first question you have to ask yourself, okay, you have a spin 2 field, but in which other sense is this a gravitational theory? Can I think of it? What is the geometrical encoding of this theory? In particular, how can I understand these two subjects? How do I define a black hole? Like, what would be a proper definition of a black hole in a Vasiliev theory? And how I identify it, how I measure its properties, and so forth. So it's been a very interesting task to kind of reinvent the wheel, if you want, and to rethink about how to define observables in these classes of theories. And if you want, this can be one of your motivations. In particular, what we wanted to do here is to generalize the notion. So motivated by all these things, one thing in particular that we wanted to understand is how to define the notion of geodesic. Because we were motivated by this proposal. So in particular, this proposal will make no sense if entanglement is related to geodesic length. What we wanted to understand was what is the, in a theory of higher spin gravity, it will make no sense to write here geodesic length. The same thing that as for the entropy of a black hole, it wouldn't make sense to write down the area of the horizon for a higher spin gravity theory. So basically, what do I write here instead? What is a natural object that will give me a geodesic notion and will reproduce for me something that's a proper distance? So basically, our paper was trying to address specifically this question. But now maybe you don't care about higher spin gravities as well. Okay, so maybe you say, okay, these are way too exotic theories for my taste. I just like to live with Einstein-Maxwell theory. And here's where my third motivation comes in. One thing that that you have to realize is that these higher spin theories actually are very intimately related to 2 plus 1 gravity. So if you want, you can forget all about this, but let me tell you a little bit about what is the higher spin nature of 2 plus 1 gravity and why thinking about this problem will actually help me doing this other problem. So this statement, it's pretty old. It's from the 80s. So one nice thing about 2 plus 1 gravity that was stated by Achukara, Townsend, and then Witten was that an Einstein-Hilbert action, so let's say that you write it in terms of a Biot line and a spin connection. So you just have the Einstein-Hilbert term. In this case, I'm going to have a negative cosmological constant. But of course, you can do it for any value of the cosmological constant. So this action, the Einstein-Hilbert action, it was observed by this set of people that it could be written in terms of two copies of a transcendence theory, in terms of two pairs of connections, A and A bar, where this transcendence action is equal to raise of A cubed. And here, the map between this pair of connections and the Biot-Bind and the spin connection is simply like this. And L is the ADS radius, so basically this in normal and appropriate units, minus 2 over L squared. And let's see, MK, the level of the transcendence theory, it's L over 4 times G newt. Okay? And these connections, if I'm in ADS, A and A bar, belong to SL2R. Okay? So the SL2 part of it tells you that you're in ADS. If you're in flat space, it's ISO. And if you're in the sitter space, it's SU. So let's see. Now, what that thing is showing to me, well, first of all, is making evident that gravity can be casted as a gauge theory. So from there, I see two facts. So I see fact number one, 3D gravity is a gauge theory, which is non-trivial. It also shows to me the topological nature makes it very evident that 3D gravity is topological, that there's no local degrees of freedom in this theory. But the other thing that is nice about this formulation is that it makes it really simple to construct higher spin theories. So if you wanted to construct a higher spin theory from this point of view, you just change your gauge group. So initially, you know that we started with with two copies of SL2R. In order to construct the higher spin theory, just change this by your favorite gauge group that contains as a subgroup SL2R. So something that is fashionable to do is to put here like SLNR. So SLNR has a subgroup, an SL2 subgroup, but it has other elements as well. And depending on how you embed SL2 into SLN, there's a way to do it such that the matter content of this theory, if you have a transcendence theory with two pairs of SLN connections, you could interpret this theory if you wanted to as a gravitational theory where you have a spin 2 field and a spin 3 up to spin n. So this is, for example, this is an example, a really simple example of a higher spin theory with a finite number of higher spin fields. And it has a feature as well, because you're still using a transcendence formulation to define this theory, they're still topological. But you can do other things. You don't have to just do SLN. So there's an example. It's called HS lambda. So in this case, HS lambda is an infinite dimensional Lie algebra. And in this case, the feature that it has is that you go from 2 up to infinity. And it's still, it's just a Trim-Simons theory defined with an infinite dimensional Lie algebra. And then there's another version where you have that it's what people properly call the Vasiliev theory. If you want, these other cases are just examples of it. That it's basically HS lambda plus scalars. And in three dimensions. And so this is the scalars are the things that will add the local degrees of freedom. They're propagating scalars in this background. So if I think of gravity in terms of a Trim-Simons theory, it's roughly, very roughly, it's the same as thinking of a higher spin theory. Like the language is the same. Like you're writing a theory in terms, like you're describing the theory from the point of view of a gauge group, as I stated there. And it's just a matter which gravitational theory or which higher spin theory you have in mind is just defining which great gauge group you're interested in. But here, it's where my initial motivation comes again. 3D gravity is a topological theory in nature. So in the context of that drawing that I made there and talking about that entanglement entropy, that geodesic length is not capturing, that prescription, that Ryu-Takanagi prescription, is not capturing the topological nature of 3D gravity. It's a local observable, but the theory itself is topological. So a question, that's why maybe you don't care about higher spin, maybe you don't care about ABS-CFT, but the basic question was like, how do I formulate a geodesic length in the Trim-Simons formulation? How does the Trim-Simons theory knows about causality, about proper distances, and how do I write that in a language that is natural from this point of view? So the basic question that you have to answer first is like, how does SL2R, Trim-Simons theory, know about geodesics? And that was our first task, to figure out how to formulate these questions, how to formulate these observables in terms of these connections. And so you can forget the rest of it if you don't care about the rest of it, and just we can just focus on answering this question, and then it's you can just go backwards, and it's kind of easy to just see how, given that you answer this question for pure gravity, you can just extend it to your favorite example that you have in mind. So does anybody know the question? It took us a while to figure it out, even though these statements have been written since 85 or 87 were those papers written, but we had to do some digging in order to find the answers to these questions.
Could I ask, do you have to, is the contour understood when k is not an integer?
What's that?
For the path integral, is the contour, is it understood when k is not an integer?
Well, I would say, okay. So this is a good question because it depends on how seriously you want to take that equality as well. So, because I would say like the sharpest version of that equality is a statement about the relationship between the equations of motion of the two theories. But okay, let's say that gravity is defined by the Trim-Simons theory. If the gauge group is not compact, there's no reason, even from the Trim-Simons point of view, why k, the level has to be an integer. So the statement that the level has to be an integer, or at least my understanding of why the level has to be an integer, it applies to compact gauge groups, if I have SU. So for a non-compact gauge group, I think people still take them to be it's a natural thing to do, but in my mind, the justification is a bit more murky. Now, if it is an integer, I still haven't been able to make sense of that path integral. So it has been difficult to even quantize the theory regardless of k being a continuous parameter or an integer. So unfortunately, in order to understand like quantum gravity, as a non-perturbative theory and understanding how to compute the full partition function. This, at least for me, it hasn't helped me in order to make sense of it. So you get answers that you can normalize. You get infinities and divergences. But we can discuss more later what are the reasons,
sure.
Or at least why I get frustrated with that. So for the purposes of this talk, I'm making a classical statement, the relationship between the two theories, and just saying that there's a map. Like, from the space of connections, I can go, well, there's an interpretation of those equations as gravitational equations. Any more questions? No? Okay. So let's answer this question. And you could have guessed from my title what the answer was. So the answer is Wilson light. So if I tell you that you have a transimence theory, there is a natural observable in this transimence theory that we most definitely did not invent it. But the natural observable, the only thing that I could think of playing with is the Wilson line operator. So the Wilson line is defined as a trace over some representation R of the path order exponential of the connection along some curve C. This object has some nice properties. Oh, well, so first I should say, so here, so this is a representation of the gauge group G. And it depends on the choice of representation, so you have to specify which representation you use, and it depends on a curve. Now, it has some nice properties. The first one is that if C is closed, so if it's a loop, then WR of C is gauge invariant. And if C is open, it only depends on endpoints. So this is what I have at hand. In a transimence theory, the natural object to study and to try to compute some observable that transforms nicely under the gauge group is the Wilson line operator. So my goal was to try to understand the geodesics, and so we had to say, okay, so the Wilson line must have somewhere hidden inside of it information about geodesics. And the nice thing is that it does in a way that it's sort of cute. So a good way to think about this problem is the following. So, okay, so I told you that it depends on two things, on the representation, and it depends on the curve. But my goal is to make connection with a geodesic. So another way of thinking of a geodesic, or a way to derive the geodesic equation, is thinking that you have a massive probe in some background. So that's one way how we usually derive the geodesic. We think that we have some massive particle, and we want to see what the dynamics of that massive particle is. So if I want this Wilson line to be associated to a geodesic, the place where I can hide, or well, I can store the information about this massive probe, the natural place will be its representation. So think of the representation of R. As a physicist, we can think of representations not just as a mathematical term, but it's useful a lot of times to think of them in terms of a Hilbert space. So you can imagine that instead of taking a trace over R, you're taking a trace over some Hilbert space. And so you can think that you had some quantum mechanical system, or, well, even a classical system, but you had some classical system and you figure out what all the possible states of that system was, and that defines for you your Hilbert space. And so taking traces over some representations are taking traces over a Hilbert space. So if I want to describe a massive probe, this Hilbert space has to have the information of what the mass and, for example, the spin of the probe is. Okay, so I want to put inside, I want to encode in here in this Hilbert space the mass and spin of the probe. Now, and this is basically the insight to tell us which representation to pick. So now you think about, okay, my gauge group that I have in hand that I'm considering is SL2R. So which representations of SL2R will be adequate to contain information about mass and spin? So fortunately, lucky us, there's basically one answer. So SL2R has the property that its representations, so if you look at reps of SL2R, they have the feature that, for example, finite dimensional representations have no data. Or by no data, I mean there's no continuous parameter that I can label as part of that representation with mass and spin. But if you look in the world of infinite dimensional reps, I can hide inside those infinite dimensional representations things that will have the mass and the spin of the particle. And so let me, for example, show to you like the highest weight representation, how the highest weight representation of SL2R will do this trick for you. So in SL2R, let's say that you have three elements, L0, L plus, and L minus, the three generators. The highest weight representation is basically defined that you pick some highest weight state that has weight H, and then you say that this guy is annihilated by the L plus, and the L minus defines for you a descendant. So this will be, so if I put it to some power n, I have some power n here. And so the label that defines the representation, and this is infinite, it's an infinite dimensional representation, and the label that defines the representation is the weight of your first field. So what I will call mass and spin, since I have two copies of SL2, is h plus h bar and h minus h bar. Or if you want the Casimirs, another way to phrase this, that the Casimir of the representation will be the continuous parameter that I'll be able to associate with M and S. So the Casimir in this language, you'll have two Casimirs for each representation. And they're basically like this.
So it corresponds to the tight part of the connection, just because you have A and A bar.
Oh, and in principle, yeah, I'm being sloppy here. If you want, I can write down a curly A that is SL2,2. But otherwise, I have two connections. Yeah, I will have two Wilson lines.
But then spin is really the type part, the E part of the connection.
It's the...
You spin, your definition of the spin.
Yes.
Corresponds really to basically the E part of the connection and the mass to the.
Oh, if the, so usually, okay, so the spin usually will couple to the spin connection.
Yeah.
And the mass will couple to the veil bind, roughly.
Oh, it's the other veil bind.
Yeah, so it depends. Okay, so there's.
Can you redefine it?
Like, it depends on how you view it a bit, because the thing is that the mass of the particle, so I would usually think, let's say if you didn't have spin, you would define like a stress tensor associated to this particle. And so the stress tensor, so.
Gives me some curvature.
Yeah, but okay, so if I have a mass, I know that the curvature will have a delta function.
Yeah.
And if I have torsion, so this will be like something like this. And if I have a if I have a modification to the torsion, it means that you have a delta function for the for the Cartan equation. So that's what I mean, that the spin couples to the connection to omega, just because the Cartan equation, I see what you're saying, yeah, because which equation, yeah, if you get the Einstein equation from varying E or omega.
Yeah.
Yeah, I
For us, it's always omega. It's kind of
Because it depends. Yeah, if you vary, if you vary E, you get the Cartan equation, and if you vary omega, you get the. But my definition here of mass and spin are exactly these definitions.
Yeah, that,
So that the curvature has a delta function, or if the torsion has a delta function. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is this that? If you do it in metric-like formulation, not in, in this Cartan formulation, usually in the literature, what people will call spin are, it's when you couple, if you have a term coupling to the Christoffel symbol. But it always, when you go from the first order formulation and the second order formulation, always, yeah, there's a little bit of a subtlety. But yeah, I think we're on the same, on the same page. But okay, so, so if I wanted to encode this data of the probe, the natural thing to do is to use this infinite dimensional representation and say that within this infinite dimensional representation, I have these two numbers, the Casimirs, and those will correspond to the mass and the spin of the probe. So the task in hand is to compute this WRC in the infinite or in the highest weight. Okay, so the claim will be that, that if I'm in the highest weight representation of SL2R, this thing, basically following this intuition, should tell me something about the geodesic equation. But we should check it explicitly. I can't just, or at least for me, it's still not obvious that the geodesic will come about. So we have to actually evaluate this Wilson line and do the explicit computation. So how will you go about evaluating a Wilson line in an infinite dimensional representation? So the way we did it is the following. So again, from this point of view, if I think of this trace as a trace over a Hilbert space, what I can do a further jump and say, okay, instead of a trace over a Hilbert space, I can write down a path interval. So I have some Hilbert space that will be describing a particle that has some mass and spin, and instead of tracing over its Hilbert space, I can integrate over the path, I can write down the path interval for that probe. So let me introduce, so you introduce an auxiliary probe that we call U. So this will be an element of the group. Well, here in my notation, sorry, not an element of the algebra, but an element of the group. And what I'll do is design a probe such that it's the free part of the path integral for this probe basically is doing the trick of computing the trace over the Hilbert space. And then in this path integral, I have to insert the path order exponential of A. And this guy, you're understanding as the evolution operator along the whorl line of this probe. And so from the point of view of the path integral, what I'm doing is coupling my auxiliary field to the connection. So this will be something in particular. So this guy over here will have local SL2R symmetry. So this is how you figure out what is the appropriate path integral to write down. And then there was blue here. And then this piece over here, sorry, this guy, this has global SL2R symmetry. And coupling to it to the connection makes the symmetry a local SL2R symmetry. So the way, the simplest way how to think about this Wilson line, I've computed it in this highest weight representation, is to, instead of writing the formula as I wrote it there, is to cast it in this way. And think of the problem of like having a probe that the free part of the probe just has the global symmetry. And when you couple it to the connection, you're making it a local symmetry. And the way that you can see explicitly that you got the right global, like that you got the right probe, is that if you have this free part, if you quantize this free particle that has global SL2R symmetry, then you end up, after quantization, with the representation that you were interested in. And so that's what we did. We basically, we constructed these two actions. And so this is, we basically, to do this, it was also useful to introduce as well, so you have the auxiliary probe and you also have its conjugate momentum that we call P. And this is an element of the algebra, actually. And so, for example, if we want to write down the free part of the probe, it looks like this. So it's a, it will be an integral along the curve. So this is where the information about the curve will go in. You define some affine parameter for this curve that we call the F. And the action looks like this. So it's the trace of P. I'm going ahead of myself. Times u dot plus there's a Lagrange multiplier enforcing the trace of p squared is equal to the Casimir of the algebra to C2. So this guy over here is assuring to me that I'm in the right representation, that I have these values. And you can check that this action is actually invariant under SL2 times SL2, provided that u transforms like a left is your right, and P is a right moving momentum, where L and R are elements of SL2R. So this action will have the appropriate global symmetries. But it only has it as a global symmetry because I only make transformations where L and R don't depend on the path itself. And here U dot just means, as well, it's a derivative with respect to the affine parameter. Now, if you want to make this local, if you want to make this invariant under local gauge transformation, so now you promote L and R to be functions of the path, the only thing you have to do is trade this this derivative. So let me, this is the mid. So you just trade this to covariant derivative, and it will roughly look, I hope I get the signs right, but it will look like that. So if you replace the normal derivative by a covariant derivative, where you're basically coupling u to the gauge field, then you will have the right transformation, the local symmetry. So this will define for you the total S. U of A is just this same thing. Going to C2. Okay. Good. So I have an explicit expression for the action and how this path integral going to look like. It still doesn't look very geodesic-like. So, yes.
Yeah, so if the gauge group was compact and you were looking at the irreducible representations, then there's a construction by Witten, right, where I think this quantum mechanics ends up being a sigma model into like line models over a flag manifold.
Yeah, yeah, if you integrate out the momentum, you get a sigma model out of here.
Do you know what the target is?
What's that? SL2R is a target. It's a sigma model with SL2R symmetry. But you can do it. Yeah, but sorry, your question was that or?
Yes, yeah, I was asking what the target of the sigma model is.
It is SL2. You don't make it compact. No, because to start with, it was SL2. So if you integrate this out, it's evident, like you get an action. It looks like a Nambu-Goto action, like we'll have like a square root. And the metric, if you want the metric in views here, yeah, like you can construct an artificial metric out of here, and the metric on this world line is a metric that has SL2 as its invariance. And that was a way, yeah. So actually, Witten and Carlip had some papers also around 89 where they were, and that was our motivation, and we knew that there was going to be some hope. And they started from that point of view, from like the sigma model point of view. That's another thing I should emphasize. That's reflected that you can pick any auxiliary probe. Like here we made one choice, but you can make any choice that you want such that this statement is true. But we just found that more useful because we wanted it to extend it to these kind of quick cases where you had SLN. And if you think of it from the sigma model point of view for SLN, it's really tedious because then the metric of that sigma model is not ADS3. It's, okay, whatever manifold you associate to SLN, and make just things really cumbersome. But you can define, yeah, if you want, I can show you later how that goes about like in detail. But okay, so we write it down like this, and this still doesn't resemble at all the geodesic part of the story, but okay, but good. So the last thing I want to tell you is actually, so here, the thing that you can notice, so we started playing around with these equations and trying to understand what the solutions of the systems were. And if you write down the equations of motion, you notice the following thing. So the equations of motion basically will look, you write down the equations of motion for you, and they basically have the following form. So let me maybe not do it out of memory. And so, they look like something like this. Oh, and actually, the signs are okay. I can't reach right now, but there's two signs there flipped. I knew that I was going to get one of those wrong. But okay. So you look at the equations, and they have basically. This form. If you integrate out P, you solve for the Lagrange constraint, you get this differential equation for U. And what we notice here, and so this A, when I write down A and A bar, it should be understood that it's A mu, it's the component of the one form along the path, okay? So as in the Wilson line, like when I write down this, it's A along the curve. And if you look at this expression and we notice that, what happens if we go to, we're entitled to set U to whatever we want. And if we set U to be equal to 1, to the identity element of the group, this equation basically boils down to the geodesic equation. So the thing that is interesting, if you make this choice, so you can solve this equation in whatever matter you want, okay? There will be different solutions for you. But what you notice is that if you enforce that U is equal to the identity element of the group, then you get an equation for the path. And if you replace it in here, you will get the geodesic equation. So it's telling you that within there's a lot of gauge symmetry here, and you can exploit that gauge symmetry. And if you make this choice of gauge, then not any path will solve the classical saddle equation for that path integral, but actually it's a geodesic equation. Like you're forcing the Wilson line to follow some particular path, which was kind of interesting because in general this whole formulation is independent. Like the Wilson line it doesn't depend which path you take. You can take any path you want, but if you make your gauge, if you go to a particular gauge, then it looks like you're forcing the system to go through a particular path. And furthermore, if you compute the action, so with this choice of gauge, if you compute S with the assumption that U is equal to 1, then you get basically you get trace of A minus A bar squared. This is basically the Veal-bind, and then if you trace it, you will get the metric, and it's just the proper distance. So you can check explicitly that if you make this choice, then the classical value of the action for this path integral is the geodesic distance. So it was hiding in there, after all. So it's very explicit that the Wilson line has the information about geodesic distance, but it has it in another nice way. Because one thing that you always have to remember is that even though you can make connection with the Wilson line with the proper distance, this guy is independent of the path. So it doesn't matter if I fix two points. The only thing that matters is where these two endpoints end up with, but I can do anything I want. I can go through a geodesic, but I also can go through some funny-shaped path, and I will get the same answer. Now, the other thing that is interesting is that if you have a black hole sitting in the middle, and let's say you compute the Wilson loop, so you decide to go through some shape around the black hole, then this guy gives you, for the SL2 case, it will give you the area of the black hole. So it will be related to the entropy of the solution. So to end, since I have just a few minutes left, let me tell you what we did with this object. One, the conclusions / some of the results. So the first thing we did is show how this Wilson line for SL2R is the right object to describe massive particles. That in some sense, this was known like a long time ago. It's just that we kind of wanted to do it like very, very explicitly and kind of like not just, like, there were a lot of papers that said these words, but we just wanted to like flesh it out as clearly as we could. Because then what we did then is kind of test this, the proposal for W of R. As a proper distance for SL3. We did it explicitly for SL3 because I guess we're lazy. and what was nice in this case, there were two things that came out nicely. One is that even if we, basically it's the same formulation. You do exactly the same thing that we did here. There's some small modifications. Now you have to write SL3 every time I wrote down SL2. You have to understand a little bit better the representations. So now you don't just have a quadratic Casimir, you also have cubic Casimirs. So there's a little bit more data.
So inside. The presentation labels are the same?
What's that?
You just have two representations?
You have two copies, but SL3 has a quadratic and a cubic Casimir, which reflects the fact that the the particle now can have mass spin and can have spin 3 charge.
So there's an additional charge.
Yeah, there's an additional charge. And so that's why you have to constrain the particle. Like, you have to decide what properties the particle you want it to have. But in this case, even if you set u equal 1, actually this choice is inconsistent. And this is something you can verify directly. And so there's never a choice. The more general statement is that there's never a choice of gauge for which you will have an equation for the path. And so the geodesic equation will never be a solution to the system. So there's no equation for the path, which is good, because I started by saying that in these theories, I couldn't have, like, the line elements or these curvature invariants were never good observables. So it better be the case that this thing doesn't tell me that there's going to be a curve, like, that it's a geodesic-like curve. And it is the case. There's no natural choice of gauge where it works. But in this case, what we also notice is that if C is closed, that it reproduces the entropy of higher spin black holes. So in this case, I should mention these higher spin black holes don't obey the Anaria law. You can compute its entropy using Euclidean methods. You can compute, like, its free energy and other things. So there are solutions. They're not just the BTC type solution. There's other solutions in these higher spin theories that have complicated, like, entropy formulas, and our Wilson loop was capable of reproducing the entropy of these black holes. So if you want, it's also providing a general definition of entropy, which is interesting. And then also, when C is open, we basically try to understand this generalization, its relation to entanglement entropy. But, well, these are the things that we've done, and basically one of the things that we want to understand better, one of our goals is basically understand better this relationship with entanglement entropy, understand better as well how to generalize it for more complicated Vasiliev-type theories. And there's other applications as well in the realm of radio CFT, but in general, I think what has been very fruitful in this area is just to understand how to define. So basically, I think our punchline, our goal was to really understand how to define observables in gravitational theories that inherently are non-local that they're not like our usual geometrical theories. And for these cases, you can make very concise and very concrete statements and conjectures, and you can test them and see how far that will take you. So that's all I have to say for today. So thank you.